Welcome to The Extra, the show that brings you the topics, issues, and people that are important to you. And today, well, it is National Bone and Joint Health Month. October is. So if your back and joints hurt, but you're not alone, because bone and joint ailments are some of the most common problems facing millions of people around the world. And we're going to take this month of October to bring attention to this alarming health problems. So joining us this morning with information on bone and joint health, Dr. Benjamin Cam, orthopedic surgery with sports medicine with Optum in Colorado Springs. Dr. Ben Cam, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Shannon. Thanks for inviting me.
So what can we do to keep our bones healthy?
Well, you know, it's an appropriate month to ask that question. You know, we're in that transition from summer to winter. And I think it's always nice to focus on a few things regarding our skeleton. You know, people think that bones are like, you know, the hard, you know, wood desk that they might sit up. But amazingly, our bones are living organs, and they actually grow, change, and turn over. So we know that kids grow, you know, with their growth plates. But amazingly, adults also have their skeleton constantly changing. So when you hear your regular doctor say, hey, you know, it's important to maintain a regular diet and also make sure that you include standard recommendations for calcium and vitamin D, those are the building blocks of our skeleton. And again, our skeleton is not static. Our bones regularly are turning over, where old bone is being taken up and new bone is being laid down. So you still want to have those building blocks around, even though you might have stopped growing height-wise. And then the other thing is,
Go ahead.
Weight-bearing stimulates the skeleton to change and do this remodeling. So, you know, if you imagine the astronauts that don't have gravity, their bones turn over differently than we do here on Earth. So resistance exercise, even well into our older years, in our 80s and 90s, has still a big benefit to us.
So that actually stimulates the bones to grow?
Yes, our skeleton is influenced by stresses and strains. And so the cells that live in our skeletal bone are stimulated to turn over by increasing or decreasing the amount of old bone that's taken up and healthy new bone that's being laid down.
What happens if we're depriving our bodies of the important nutrients that you kind of touched on a bit ago?
Well, that's a great question. So a very common thing to happen is, as the weather gets a little bit colder, people spend a little bit more time indoors. And if you don't get a lot of sunlight, the conversion to active forms of vitamin D in your skin slows down. Vitamin D in its active form actually mediates the absorption of calcium from your diet. So even though you might be having a normal diet, if you don't have enough vitamin D, the processes to absorb calcium and then use it to lay down and form new bone are affected.
So what kind of daily activities, in addition to taking those supplements, et cetera, what kind of daily activities can we do that could improve our skeletal system?
In addition to resistance exercise, so actually working at a gym, if you don't have a gym or weights at home to work out with, definitely being active is important. And fortunately, we live here in the great state of Colorado, where there are many activities to stay active, the first of which is simply walking. So getting out and enjoying a nice hike and walk can be very beneficial to maintaining your hip, knee, and ankle strength, which is very important. And if that's not super easy for you to do, using a third point of contact with the ground, like a walking stick or a cane, can be beneficial to make sure that you don't trip and fall too easily as you get out on the trails, or as the weather gets cold enough to have the ground a little bit icy. It does help to have that third point of contact with the ground.
What brought you to this field of study?
Well, interestingly, when I was in the Air Force, I was trying to decide on a specialty and ended up doing a field course with an orthopedic surgeon. And he really seemed to love what he did. And he kind of mentored me into doing this. And I found it amazingly fulfilling throughout the active duty time when we would deploy to various places in the Middle East. And my last deployment to Afghanistan, super fulfilling to help people that are injured, get them up, walking and living their life again.
Wow, wow. And I'm guessing through this, you've come to see how much we all depend on our bones and joints for just a basic quality of life.
Absolutely. You know, I had the pleasure of being able to take care of children in the growing phases in which, you know, their bone and growth plates can be the weakest part and often can get injured or fractured. I take care of, you know, middle-aged adults who are still active and mountain biking, skiing, and unfortunately suffer injuries, sports injuries, and our aging population that sometimes if they trip and fall and have a hip fracture, or if their joints wear out, sometimes we have an amazing technology to actually replace a joint. So it's been a very fulfilling thing for me.
Well, we are going to continue the discussion with Dr. Ben Kam, an orthopedic surgeon with Optum out of sports medicine with Optum in Colorado Springs. If you would like more information, Colorado Springs Family Physicians and Urgent Care is the place to go. You can find that at optum.com or cshp.net. We'll be continuing the conversation here on The Extra up next, talking about joint pain. That's coming up as The Extra continues. We're back with The Extra and Dr. Ben Kam, an orthopedic surgeon of sports medicine with Optum in Colorado Springs. Dr. Kam, we were talking about bones before, but joint pain is something that a lot of people are impacted by. What kind of therapies are available for people who are experiencing joint pain?
Well, Shannon, thanks for asking that. You know, our major joints are critical to our ability to go throughout our regular day, both for walking and for lifting, bending, and doing regular daily activities. And the therapies for joint pain range from non-invasive to kind of invasive. Non-invasive treatments for joint pain typically include modifying your activities. So if you happen to be in a job that is quite labor intensive and stressful, having some workplace modifications ergonomically or some restrictions that your doctor can place on how much you lift and push and pull can make a big difference. Secondly, oral anti-inflammatory medications can be very helpful. Over-the-counter things like Advil and Aleve can be helpful, but sometimes prescription medications for arthritis can also be helpful. Third, physical therapy, very helpful in many aspects of joint pain for making sure you don't lose motion in a painful joint, and also maintaining the strength of the muscles around that joint to keep your locomotion and your strength and ability to lift and push and pull. Fourth, assist devices can be helpful. So, for example, if you were to use a cane, it could take up to 30% of your body weight off the other leg. So if I had a cane in my right hand, up to 30% weight bearing relief for my left leg. And finally, injection therapy can also be helpful as another non-operative option in which medications directly, specifically at decreasing inflammation and helping with the pain, can be injected directly into the joint that's the offending one for you and make a big difference in your overall pain.
Well, I myself experienced joint pain in my thumb joint, and I have had the injection for it. And I know there are different types. So why don't you describe some of the different forms of injection therapy?
Sure. Well, currently, the most common types of joint injection, you know, there are four of them. probably a lot of people have heard of a steroid injection or a cortisone corticosteroid injection. The second would be a gel type injection, which is called visco supplementation. The third type can include PRP or platelet rich plasma, special technique in which your own blood is drawn, spun in a centrifuge in which the blood products are split into red blood cells, white blood cells, plasma, and platelets, and the platelet-rich portion of your blood is re-injected into your joint. And then finally, people have heard of stem cell type injections in which either stem cells like bone marrow from your own bone marrow are taken, spun in a centrifuge, and just the stem cells are injected into your joint, or situations in which amniotic, human amniotic lining is taken and broken up into the small pieces and cells, and that is injected into the joint.
Wow.
Four main types of injections.
And you work with your doctor to determine which type would be the appropriate form of injection?
Absolutely. You know, for many people, their primary care doctor can be very, very helpful in both discussing this and in determining what might work best. And if your primary care doctor doesn't offer those types of injections, they would know who to send you to who could.
Are there risks of joint injection therapy?
Yes, as you might imagine, anything that's a little invasive in which we actually have to either draw your blood or have to poke a needle into a joint has some risks. And those risks are relatively minor in the sense that when we poke anything through the skin, there's a small or minor risk for infection. But secondarily, for example, some medications like steroids can temporarily cause blood sugar elevations or imbalance if you happen to have diabetes, for example. Secondarily, there are some recent medical reports that suggest that multiple steroid injections can predispose you to having a risk or increased risk of infection if later on you decide to get a joint replacement in that same joint, or possibly have other procedures like a rotator cuff repair surgery in the shoulder may increase the chance that the healing may be impacted.
Are these joint pains directly related to, say, aging, or do they range the gamut?
A lot of the joint pain that I see in my clinic happens to be pain from arthritis. And arthritis is the progressive wearing out, so to speak, of the cartilage lining of your joints. So if you think of the smooth, rubbery, shock-absorbing cartilage on the end of a chicken bone, that's kind of like what our cartilage feels like in your native knee. But over the course of years of playing high school sports, downhill skiing, you know, sometimes, for example, in your knee, that nice, perfect lining can sustain some damage and wearing out. And so typically, as it wears out and we develop arthritis, that is the most common reason, I'd say, of developing joint pain. There are some other sources for joint pain. Sometimes pain can be referred from other joints. For example, problems in your hip could feel like knee pain and vice versa. And then sometimes joint pain can be caused by an underlying inflammatory arthritis. You know, people have heard of rheumatoid arthritis. That is not necessarily from the wearing out of the cartilage per se, but the inflammation of the lining of the knee joint, which has a lot of nerve endings and can be very painful.
Mm. Enlightening, Dr. Cam, especially I'm sure a lot of folks who are listening right now may have wondered, you know, what kind of therapies are out there and where their joint pain is coming from. So interesting to hear that. We're talking with Dr. Ben Cam, orthopedic surgeon with Sports Medicine with Optum in Colorado Springs. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to cshp.net. We are going to be coming back in the second half and talking about surgery and how that's changed, as well as rotator cuff disease. Are there any people out there who are predisposed to it? That and much more coming up as we focus on bone and joint health. It is the month for it, October. We'll be talking about that as the Extra continues. We're back with the Extra here on KRDO News Radio. October is National Bone and Joint Health Month. Our expert joining us today from Optum as we mark our Optum Ask the Doctor segment of the month, Dr. Ben Kam, an orthopedic surgeon in sports medicine. So, Dr. Kam, how has joint replacement surgery changed over the last 20 years?
Well, Shannon, it has changed significantly. 20 years ago, replacing your joint would possibly be a very painful process that may have required consideration for blood transfusion because it was kind of a bloody surgery and people would lose blood and end up staying in the hospital for 3 to 5 days. It has now changed to where most patients of mine really only spend overnight in the hospital. If that, and a number of my patients now go home the same day, which is a huge change from what it used to be like. Transfusions for blood loss are rare. And complications that require people to stay in the hospital are, again, very uncommon.
What indications are there for needing joint replacement surgery? I'm assuming people who need it have gone through other types of therapies with no success.
Yes, you're totally right. I think that the main indication for joint replacement surgery is pain. Pain that is not relieved by all the non-operative options. And you know, I kind of went over the non-operative options before, and they include attempts at restricting your activities, oral medications, physical therapy, use of a cane or a brace, or injection therapy. And once you've tried or considered those things, or those no longer last long enough to make a difference for you, you typically would be considered a candidate for joint replacement surgery. The pain typically would have to be fairly severe, meaning that it restricts your activities of daily living. So your ability to go up and down stairs in your home, walk for distance, being able to get dressed, use a bathroom and take a shower, once it's impacting those daily activities and none of those other things help, again, we consider joint replacement.
What happens once you make that decision? I mean, it is a serious decision. I assume there's a process.
Yes. So I think it's important to understand that once you decide on surgery, making sure that you have a surgical team, so that you've met a surgeon that is experienced in this, and they typically will have a protocol or process for you to go through. So in the case of my patients, we do a preoperative screening protocol that might include visiting with your primary care doctor to go over your medications and your past history. And if, for example, you have a history of some underlying medical disease, it could include some tests ahead of time. That might include some blood work. It could even include a stress test to make sure that your heart and organs could undergo the stress of a major operation. You might even be referred to your dentist to make sure that you don't have an underlying infection in your mouth that might need to be treated before surgery. Once that's done, typically we decide on a location for the surgery, whether it's in an ambulatory surgery center or in the hospital. And then typically a consenting process to make sure that you understand all the risks and benefits with the surgery itself. And someone has talked to you about your household. You know, do you have a lot of stairs in the house? You know, are you living in an area where you have some good family or friend support that could help you out for the first few weeks after surgery? And whether it's safe for you to go back with, you know, use of a walker, for example, if you were to have a hip or a knee replacement surgery, to be able to get around your home with that walker.
And then on the day of surgery, describe the process.
So when people check in, typically they will meet their preoperative nursing staff that will make sure that all the appropriate paperwork and your insurance is in order. Make sure that the consent and history paperwork are available, and you'll meet the anesthesiologist who will talk about the important part about making sure you don't feel anything pain-wise when you go through the surgery itself. Patients will then move to the operating room where they'll meet the operative team. And typically a process will go through to get patients positioned and ready for prep, which basically will include some type of skin prep that sterilizes the skin. People will also get some medications that might include medications to minimize bleeding, antibiotics in preparation for lowering the risk for infection, and then the surgery itself happens. Afterwards, patients may end up working with a physical therapy team to refresh or learn the appropriate ways of getting up and around safely in the house after surgery. So practicing how to get in and out of a car, on and off the toilet, in and out of bed, in and out of a shower. So some basic things that you might not be used to if you're using a walker or crutches.
Interesting. Well, and certainly learning about all of this helps prepare those of us who may have thought that this might be the next step in our managing or dealing with bone or joint health issues. But if you aren't affected by it yet, don't worry. There's a chance that you could be later on down the line, because a lot of people do experience this as they get older. October is National Bone and Joint Health Month. Our expert on the extra today, Dr. Benjamin Cam, an orthopedic surgeon with Optum in Colorado Springs. We're going to continue the conversation in just a couple minutes. Need to take a short break. You're listening to KRDO News Radio. We're back with our final segment on KRDO News Radio's The Extra. Today, we are focusing the discussion on bone and joint health because it is October, and that is National Bone and Joint Health Month. Our expert today from Optum, Dr. Benjamin Cam, an orthopedic surgeon. So, Dr. Cam, we were talking about a lot of different types of bone or joint health issues, but one issue that affects a lot of folks out there, I know, rotator cuff pain, pain of the shoulders. Can you tell us about that?
Of course. So, Shannon, the rotator cuff is a group of four muscles that are very small. They're not ones that you can actually see from the outside. And they kind of grab onto the ball of the ball and joint, shoulder joint, and help stabilize it when you reach out and use your arm to do certain functions. I'd say that people don't realize how important muscular control of your shoulder is until I explain that the only connection, bony connection, of your entire arm to your skeleton is your collarbone. And so people are surprised by this. They say, how can that skinny little bone be responsible for holding the whole weight of my arm, for example, if I'm lifting weights? And the answer is the bone itself is not fully responsible for that. It's actually very big muscles that attach from your chest wall to your shoulder blade that perform that stabilizing function to allow your arm to pivot and rotate off of that. So when we talk about the rotator cuff, it's an essential stabilizing part of the shoulder for daily activities.
And is there a disease that can impact this?
Well, if we call rotator cuff disease a disease, yes. But some people feel that it might be actually an aging process that we all go through. Uh-huh. That if you live long enough, the rotator cuff itself will end up wearing out.
Deteriorating.
So you find that, yeah, that if you were to take, for example, 60 men aged, or I'm sorry, 100 men aged 60 or older, off the street with no shoulder pain, and we put them in a scanner, like an MRI scanner, to look at their rotator cuff, we'd find a high incidence of disease of the rotator cuff. You know, 40 to 60% of those would have positive findings. But they don't have any shoulder pain, so how could that be? Well, we do think that some aspects of daily life can cause some wear and tear of the rotator cuff. But it's only those people that actually develop a painful syndrome, thus the disease, that actually may need some treatment. And the span of treatments can range from non-operative to operative.
Would you say that people who are in physical labor employment or who do a lot of, say, weightlifting, would you say they are predisposed to this, or is it just run the gamut?
So, yes, in general, I'd say that our folks who are doing the hard work on the front lines of a labor-intensive job like construction or electricians, people who have to work at the level of their shoulder or above, so over their head, drywall overhead, pretty notorious, painters, can definitely overuse their shoulder quite a bit. And unfortunately, in some cases, overuse it to the point that they develop wear and tear injuries to the rotator cuff. As I mentioned before, age definitely is predisposing. If you smoke, there's definitely medical literature to suggest that it can predispose you to increasing your chance of rotator cuff disease and, of course, trauma. So if you happen to be in a sport that maybe takes some injuries to the shoulder, or if you do a sport per se, like contact sport, like football or rugby, that can also predispose you to injury.
What can be done about that kind of injury?
The vast majority of rotator cuff disease has a lot of medical studies that have looked at both conservative and operative care. And certainly the vast majority of people can be treated conservatively, meaning no surgery, no invasive things, but probably a formal physical therapy program. So going to an experienced physical therapist that knows how to help with rehabilitation of the shoulder itself, possibly along with some over-the-counter or prescription anti-inflammatory medicine, can be very beneficial. And I'd say the majority of patients can be treated that way. However, patients that end up getting referred to orthopedic surgeons obviously may have already tried that and failed to improve. And so those are the people that go on to surgery.
Well, very interesting. Our conversation today has been with Dr. Ben Kam, an orthopedic surgeon with Optum in Colorado Springs. If you'd like to find out more information, their website can be found at cshp.net. And Dr. Kam's last name is K-A-M, so you can look him up there. Dr. Kam, for your expertise and for shedding so much light on a very big topic, so much to tackle today, in talking about bone health and joint pain, I give you two thumbs up. One of them very arthritic, but two thumbs up. So thank you. Thank you for sharing your expertise with our audience and with everyone here at KRDO News Radio.
You're welcome, Shannon. Thank you.
It has been our Ask the Doctor Extra show here on KRDO News Radio. Thank you for listening.